والسلام على أفضل المرسلين سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a privilege to be here today. Having been invited by Michael Ankrum, needless to say, I regret that he is not here. But as His Excellency Secretary Jack Straw said, for family reasons he couldn't. We wish him well. And to have received such laudatory words from a man like Jack Straw is really also quite a privilege for me. Himself needs no recognition for all the good works that he has done, not just in government, but even outside of government. My topic today is about the Middle East problem, perennial problem, Palestine, Israel, and Syria and Lebanon. Back in 1945, as a matter of fact, just a day before I was born, the late King Abdulaziz met with President Roosevelt in the Red Sea, and President Roosevelt had come from Yalta on his way back to the United States and wanted to meet with the late King Abdulaziz to get to know him and to discuss issues with him. Paramount among them was to convince King Abdulaziz that he should support the increase in number of Jewish refugees from Europe to go to Palestine as a result of Nazi persecution of the Jews in Europe, among other subjects that were discussed at the time. And the late King, in answer to that proposition to President Roosevelt, said, well, if the Jews are persecuted by the Nazis in Germany, why bring them to Palestine? Why not compensate them by giving them the best lands in Germany? And that would be the just and right thing to do. In any case, both sides could not agree on a specific way to go forward from there, other than for President Roosevelt to assure the late King that he would do nothing on that issue subsequently until he consulted with Arab leaders. Alas, a couple of months after that, or I think 2.5 months after that, the late president died, and things moved on from there, and the rest is history. I refer to that incident just to show you how long the issue of Palestine has been with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. If I want to go further back, I would refer to King Abdulaziz's many letters that he sent to the British government in the 30s as well, when the mandate territory of Palestine was going through troubles between Jewish immigrants from Europe and the local Palestinians, and there were several uprisings on both sides that the British forces had to put down. Since then, and if we come to the present times and see where we stand today, I think I would refer back to what was asked of an American historian, and I got his name this time, Mr. Secretary, Will Rogers, who wrote a huge multi-volume history of the world back in the early 20th century. And when he was finished with that, a reporter asked him how he saw the history of the world. And without any hesitation, the historian answered back, "It's one damn thing after another." And unfortunately, I think in Palestine, it is one damn thing after another. When the President Obama campaigned in 2007 and subsequently won the election in 2008 and made those very uplifting statements about the Middle East and about the Palestinian issue, expectations, needless to say, rose very high in the Middle East. And those expectations were confirmed when his first call after he entered the Oval Office in the White House was to President Mahmoud Abbas. His first television interview after entering the White House was to Al Arabiya station, etc. Secretary Clinton, on her visits after that to the Middle East, also made some very positive statements, particularly about settlements and the condemnation of Israeli actions in Jerusalem about destroying Palestinian homes and evicting Palestinian residents of those homes out in the street. So you can imagine what people in the Arab world and the Muslim world felt that finally there is an administration, particularly after the previous administration's almost very lackadaisical way of ceding advantage in the Middle East problem to Israel on every issue. It appeared that this new administration would take the bull by the horns and tackle this very important and very internationally very disturbing situation and hopefully put it to rest. Subsequent to that, the visit to Cairo and the famous speech by President Obama addressing the Muslim world further raised expectations. Alas, all of those expectations came to naught very soon after that, and not much longer after that, when the issue of settlements pressed forcefully at the beginning of the administration was subsequently dropped by the administration, like the hot ball it was, but nonetheless it seemed that the President and the Secretary of State, not considering how hot the ball is, didn't manage to wear any gloves when they were tried to carry it. So they dropped it, and the disappointment is equally great as the expectation was before they made those statements. And we reach today and see what is happening on the ground. Nothing. No negotiations. Continued Israeli settlement. Continued eviction of Palestinian families from their homes. Continued destruction of olive groves and other Palestinian interests in the West Bank, and a very unacceptable blockade of Gaza, where the humanitarian situation is awful. And I have not been to Gaza, but I have heard from people who have, and they tell me that no one in any capacity could accept that as being a normal state of affairs. So these issues definitely have impact on all of us in the Middle East, old and young, man and woman, settled and Bedouin, whatever part of society or strata of society you come from. Palestine is there to remind Arabs and Muslims that there is still a legacy of colonialism in our part of the world, which refuses to go away. At a time when everybody now is in a post-colonial period. And as such, I will add that on the Syrian and Lebanese front as well, the Israelis continue to occupy territories, despite the fact that so many United Nations resolutions have been passed calling for the removal of that occupation, and all of the efforts that were put in place to effect that removal have come to naught. The kingdom, of course, is famous for its initiative presented by King Abdullah when he was crown prince in 2002. But I will respectfully remind you that before that, almost 20 years before that, the late King Fahd also presented a peace initiative to the Arab League, which was called the Fahd Peace Plan. And all the Arab states signed on to it back in 1981-82, which at that time took the extraordinary step of finally recognizing among the Arab countries that there is such a thing as a state of Israel that exists with borders, and that all the countries should be within those borders that they had before June 1967. On both occasions, the Fahad peace plan and the Abdullah peace plan, a 20-year span, the Israelis simply didn't accept any of these propositions. In the first case, the Fahad peace plan was not even mentioned by Israel, let alone commented upon or made into any kind of discussion by the Israelis. The second one, the first reaction of Israel was a statement by the advisor to Mr. Ariel Sharon, who was then Prime Minister in Israel, and he said that this was the most dangerous proposition for Israeli security. The Arabs extending their hands in peace with an equitable solution that takes into consideration Israeli requirements, historic requirements, since its creation back in 1948, for Arab recognition, normal relations, diplomatic representation, and cessation of hostilities. These were always Israeli demands from the beginning, and the Arab peace plan in 2002 offered that in return for Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories of 1967, including East Jerusalem, as a capital for the state of Palestine, but also an equitable solution and agreed upon solution for the refugee problem. These, from the Arab point of view, were extraordinary concessions and realistic requirements for a durable peace between the Arabs and Israel. And as I said, the immediate reaction of Israel was to consider this the most dangerous proposition for Israel to undertake. Subsequent to that, of course, we heard statements from Ehud Olmert and Tzipi Livni and President Peres that there were certain words or certain considerations within the Arab peace plan that Israel should pursue, etc. But never, not once, has there ever been a declaration by Israel that, yes, we accept, let's negotiate on that issue. And since the coming of Mr. Netanyahu, even that has not been given either in public or in private. So you can see where Israel has come from and where the Arabs continue to pursue that peace. In the last summit meeting of the Arabs, not just the economic summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, but the previous one in Sirte in Libya, there was a reaffirmation of the Arab peace plan as being still on the table. But for how long? Yesterday in the House of Commons, I was asked by somebody, why doesn't Saudi Arabia talk to Israel about the danger, the security danger of Iran to both countries? And my answer was, why should we talk to Israel, having been treated so cavalierly by all Israeli governments in all the strategic propositions that the kingdom has made? So it is up to the Israelis to come forward. Back in November, I was in the United States, and I spoke at various fora like this one, not as distinguished, but nonetheless quite worthy of talking to. Many questions were raised at that time about whether we can go on as Arabs keeping the Arab Peace Initiative on the table. My proposition, ladies and gentlemen, is that the Arab Peace Initiative is the best tool to serve Arab strategic interests, not just for today, but also for the future. And as such, the onus is on the Israelis to come forward with their own peace initiative, which they don't do. We've heard of the Rogers Plan, we've heard of the Kissinger shuttle diplomacy, we've heard of the Soviet interventions for peace when the Soviet Union was still alive. Subsequently, the Russian Federation has proposed to hold a meeting in Moscow, etc. We've heard from the Europeans where they stand on that issue. Even the quartet roadmap, President George W. Bush's two-state proposition, but not once have we heard of an Israeli peace plan. All we see is more destruction, more occupation, more imprisonment for Palestinians, and nothing to come forward other than let's talk. And talk on what? They continue to say they want to talk, but they don't talk about anything. They just keep delaying and delaying and delaying, and it is not in anybody's interest for that situation to continue. I have suggested in my previous presentations before audiences like yours that one of the first things Israel can do to bring down the level of calumny and heightened tension in the area is to withdraw from Shab'a Farms in Lebanon. I understand from Lebanese that the area of Shab'a Farms is smaller than Parliament House on the Thames, and hence has absolutely no strategic value to the Israelis. Yet they maintained their occupation of it with the excuse that when they occupied it back in 1967, they occupied it from the Syrians and that they will not give it back to the Lebanese. My proposition to them is give it to the United Nations and let that be a problem between the Lebanese and the Syrians. You have no right to be in that place, and by withdrawing from Shab'a Farms, the tensions in Lebanon would immediately subside, because that step will deprive Hezbollah and others within Lebanon that carry the banner of national liberation from having that banner in their hands. And by dropping that banner, Hezbollah and others like it in Lebanon will truly then become political parties and not armed militias fighting for the liberation of Lebanese territory. And we've seen the effects of that national liberation banner being carried by Hezbollah in Lebanon since 1982, and even today with the formation of this new government in Lebanon. And Israel can be very helpful if it would withdraw from Shab'a Farms. But does Israel want to be helpful? I don't think so, because all of the actions that they have taken show that they merely want to continue the obstructive and destructive policy that they have followed for the last 30, 40 years since occupying Arab lands. In Syria, Golan, President Assad, for the last 4 or 5 years, has been pushing the Israelis for negotiations. He, with the help of the Turkish friends, almost reached a kind of agreement on to go forward in direct talks with Israel. A brief reminder of that status of issues back in 2008. At the very end of that year, when Prime Minister Erdogan was playing the role of mediator and having reached agreement between President Bashar al-Assad and Prime Minister Ehud Olmert on carrying forward their talks on Golan, the Prime Minister was surprised by the devastating attack that took place on Gaza at the end of that year. And it just seemed incredible, not just for Mr. Erdogan, but I'm sure for Mr. Assad as well, that while the Israelis were talking about going forward on Golan and reaching some kind of agreement with the Syrians, that they would do what they did in Gaza with the resulting bloodshed and, I must say, worldwide condemnation of the Israeli action. Yet Israel continues. And it does so and has shown what it feels about world opinion by the next attack that it took place against the peace flotilla that was going to try to break the quarantine around Gaza. And we just saw the results of Israeli investigative capabilities into the rights and wrongs of that action in the report that they put out justifying that attack and the murder of 10 Turkish participants in that flotilla. I could go on and on, ladies and gentlemen, with more examples of what is happening on the ground in Palestine and Gaza to show where the Israelis stand and where the Palestinians and the Arab countries stand. But I will not do that. You all know the story. I'm grateful that you gave me the time to repeat it in front of you. But as I said in a talk I gave yesterday, if you dissect an Arab and or a Muslim to the tiniest portion of his or her cellular structure, you will discover that the word Palestine is inside that. And it is from that context, I think, that a country like the United Kingdom, with its past history and connection, not just with Palestine, but with the rest of us in the Middle East, to come forward and play a more engaged role in seeking that peace. And how can Britain do that? I think it can do it in several ways. One of them, of course, is to urge and to push your very close ally, the United States, to come forward and put its foot down. President Obama has talked the talk, but he hasn't walked the walk. And he needs to do that. And he needs his friends to tell him that he must do that. I think Britain can also play a very active role in urging other friends of Israel from within the Jewish community and outside the Jewish community, in this country and outside this country, that if they want to be true friends of Israel, that they must push the Israelis to accept the reality of a Palestinian state contiguous on its borders and living in peace and harmony with Israel. Britain can also play another role. Britain can push the European Union to use its economic muscle with the Palestinians and with the Israelis to move forward on those issues. The European Union is the biggest trading partner for Israel. It is also the biggest contributor to Palestinian Authority funding. So those roles can be played by the European Union with British helping and support for that action. These are just three examples of where I think the UK can be very, very productive in moving this issue forward. It is not only we who suffer from this Palestinian problem. The whole world does. The terrorism that has emanated from our part of the world and that has struck not just the kingdom and other countries in the Middle East, but also has struck the heart of London and other European and American cities and capitals. Whether we like to say it or not, ladies and gentlemen, it is linked to the Palestinian problem. because the terrorists use the Palestinian problem to justify their actions, and they use the Palestinian problem to recruit young people who are frustrated and who feel a sense of loss, not only of themselves, but of the dignity and the stature when they look at the pictures coming out of Palestine and the suffering that the Palestinian peoples have to endure. There are other reasons for the terrorists to act. I would not be one to deny that. The kingdom has faced these terrorists since it was established back in 1932. But the driving force that allows Bin Laden and others like him to recruit across the internet from British citizens, American citizens, French citizens, Spanish citizens, Chechen citizens in Russia, Chinese Uyghurs, Indian Muslims, Indonesian young people, etc. The list can go on and on. In every country, you will find one or two or perhaps more young people being drawn to this criminal activity of Bin Laden and his cohorts because the banner of Palestine is up there and the suffering of the Palestinian people. From the experience of Saudi Arabia, when we saw, for example, after the American invasion of Iraq back in 2003, that young Saudis were crossing into Iraq, going via Syria on one side and Iran on the other side. And when they were captured, those who were captured by the Iraqis, and some of them were finally returned to the kingdom, the reason they gave was that they were fighting the enemies of Islam. And when the question was, what do you mean by enemies of Islam? Say, well, the people who are occupying Palestine and now want to occupy Iraq. The connection is there between Palestine and the things and the criminal acts that we suffer from in the whole world. And it is incumbent on people of goodwill and good sense to put this back in order. I've come to the close of my talk. I would not dare deny Jack Straw any request. But let me just finish by saying that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, under the leadership of King Abdullah, will continue to pursue whatever measures can be pursued in reaching peace. Peace with justice, but also peace for all. You can't have justice for the Israelis and deny justice for the Palestinians. And you can't have justice for the Israelis and deny justice for the Lebanese and for the Syrians. So the UK has a primary role to play, and I think it should. And please remember that your sons are now engaged in this struggle. It's not an easy thing coming from Saudi Arabia and seeing as how destructive this terrorism is and what measures the leaders of that terrorism will use to justify their actions. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.